WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Well, with me in the studio now is Fresh Air's Danny Miller, who has a special report on how the press covers the CIA.
Thanks, Terry. The Covert Action Information Bulletin is published about 5 times a year in Washington, D.C., featuring articles on different CIA activities around the world. Past issues have included stories on CIA efforts to recruit foreign diplomats, spying activity in Italy, media destabilization in Jamaica, right-wing terrorism, and CIA activity in Zimbabwe, Salvador, Guatemala, Denmark, Sweden, and Grenada. Its most recent issue focuses on mercenary activities in South Africa and South America. Its board of directors includes Philip Agee, a former CIA agent who left the agency in 1969. In 1975, he published a book titled CIA Diary, which named names, that is, revealed the identities of undercover CIA agents and detailed the nature of their covert activities. Agee's book was blamed when later that year a CIA operative was murdered in Athens, Greece. The best-known component of the Covert Action Information Bulletin is a regular feature which, for the time being, is no longer being printed. It is the Naming Names column, which, like the Philip Agee book CIA Diary, reveals the names of undercover CIA agents and describes the nature of their activities. Unlike Agee's book, which is based on classified information he had access to as a CIA agent from 1957 through 1969, the bulletin claims it relies on unclassified information which is publicly known from journalistic accounts or is available from unclassified government documents or other public sources. Naming Names has been temporarily suspended as a bulletin feature because of legislation which is now pending. This legislation is directed against the practice of exposing names or other information related to U.S. undercover activities or operatives and would make it a crime to publish such information, even if it is available from unclassified government documents or in other ways drawn from public sources. The editors of the Covert Action Information Bulletin feel that they don't want to be the initial victims of legislation which may ultimately involve the mainstream establishment press and are waiting to see how this legislation will evolve before reinstituting the Naming Names column. Both the Senate and the House have approved this legislation, but with some wording differences which are presently being worked out. The advocates of the legislation claim that they are primarily interested in stopping publications like the Covert Action Information Bulletin, but other news publications, like the Washington Post and the New York Times, have said in editorials that this legislation disregards constitutional protections designed to guarantee freedom of speech and, if enacted into law, would seriously threaten their ability to cover the news concerning the CIA and the FBI. We're about to hear a conversation I recently had with Kenneth Lawrence, a regular contributor to the Covert Action Information Bulletin and a member of its board of advisors. Following this interview, in about a half hour, we'll hear from Stephen Rosenfeld, an editorial writer for The Washington Post, regarding the Post's objections both to the proposed legislation and to the Covert Action Information Bulletin. Let me give you a little more information about Kenneth Lawrence. He lives in Mississippi, where he moved in 1971 as a reporter for the Southern Patriot newspaper. Much of his writing focused on alleged FBI activities directed against civil rights workers. From 1977 through 1979, he was the director of an American Friends Service Committee project intended to investigate FBI surveillance of civil rights workers in Mississippi. Lawrence is a regular contributor to the Covert Action Information Bulletin and a member of its board of advisors. When I spoke with him about a week ago, I asked him to explain what he felt the objectives of the magazine were.
We want to expose as much as possible of what we perceive to be the wrongdoing of the intelligence agencies, which includes exposing their personnel and methods. That is that we believe that people who carry out these activities need to be held responsible for them personally as well as matters of policy. And it's really, I think, a relatively straightforward application of the Nuremberg principle, you know, that it's not legitimate just to carry out orders if what you're doing is something that is morally reprehensible and against every sense of justice and international law and so forth. And so that's why we publish what we do. Now, I hasten to add that we publish a lot more than the Naming Names column. It's the CIA that has made that the issue, the scapegoat for what we do. One of the ironies, however, is that they say there are only two kinds of secrets that they really want to protect. One is the names of their agents, and that's a fraudulent claim, which we can discuss in a minute. The other is their sources and methods of intelligence, and my column in the bulletin is called Sources and Methods. So who knows what they'll do next. A lot of points have been made about the naming names. One is that if we're able to identify these people using nothing but unclassified public information, then anybody else who wants to, including hostile foreign powers, could do the same thing. And so this bill in Congress, the Intelligence Identities Protection Act, that's intended to put us out of business, is not going to stop people from identifying covert CIA agents in foreign countries.
Are all your sources either unclassified or declassified information?
For that stuff, sure. Comes out of the diplomatic lists and so forth. And the way those people are identified has been known for a long time. It was originally revealed generally in an article in the magazine Washington Monthly in 1970. There's some irony in that, since the Washington Monthly has editorially supported the Identities Act, that they were the first ones, in fact, to show how to do this in an article called How to Spot a Spook by John Marks.
Is there much debate, or is there any debate about when not to name a name?
Sure.
Is there a sense of, do you have a forward sense of what the consequences to the person that you're naming might be?
Well, certainly, and it's not, we haven't had to make the point. Such sterling analysts as Richard Helms and William Colby have pointed out that when people go into this kind of work, they don't think they're joining the Boy Scouts. They know it's dirty work. They know that it consists of corrupting and overthrowing governments, of betraying people and institutions, and includes bribery and blackmail and interfering with people's personal lives and framing them up and forgery and all the rest of it. They know that. We know that. The general public probably is becoming increasingly aware of it. Nevertheless, there are situations, and this is another one of the ironies of this work. We are besieged all the time by journalists from every national and international medium for assistance. They always want to know what can we tell them about this, that, and the other, including, for example, the reporters who work for Jack Anderson, who then turns around and condemns us in his columns. I think this is one of those things. And one of the specific examples that I think shows that, in fact, we, unlike many of them, are not seeking to sensationalize this stuff, but have a better grasp on the consequences and what the responsibilities are of journalists in this field. We did not name the names of any of the CIA agents in the U.S. Embassy in Tehran during the entire hostage crisis, despite the fact that we were asked almost daily by the various national media and wire services for that information.
Why didn't you?
Because we felt that it was a unique situation which was unpredictable, and that we did not want to do anything that could possibly worsen the situation.
I see, because there is a gray area as far as similar points at which you might name an agent's name, and there's the same degree of unpredictability regarding what at least the consequences to the agent would be. Is there much editorial discussion about that?
We discuss it all the time.
What are the issues that are most prominent?
Well, the basic point of it. Let me give you a more specific example than the kind that are often, I think, caricatured in the press about how we work and what we're trying to accomplish. We published much of our stuff in a book called Dirty Work 2, the CIA in Africa. And I edited the chapters and wrote a couple of them on CIA academics. These are scholars who are actually operatives or contract agency for the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, in the course of my research, I learned that James Hooker, one of the leading Africanists in the United States at the University of Michigan, was a CIA agent from the time that he got out of college. And I published that in the book. Now, some people wonder, well, why do you do this sort of thing? And doesn't that risk that person's life, career, or whatever? In this particular case, the Hooker is now deceased, so that's not a a factor. But even people who don't agree with my criticisms of the CIA would have to acknowledge, I think, that this man who was masquerading as a Marxist, that was his public image. All of his published scholarly articles, he wrote a major book that became quite important to leftists and nationalists and liberation movements in this country and elsewhere, which was a biography of George Padmore called Black Revolutionary, George Padmore's Path from Marxism to Pan-Africanism. That was the title of the book. It was published by Prager in 1969. Now, when people read that, they took it at face value. This was a Marxist scholar evaluating a leading African independence figure. Now, I think people would have had an entirely different view, judgment, criticism, evaluation of that book if they had known that, in fact, it was the work of a CIA agent building cover than what they took it to be. I think there's no question that that sort of thing corrupts scholarship and that it's a matter of much wider concern than just to people like me who are critics of the agency. I mean, it poses questions that a whole range of people should have to deal with. But because this debate focuses so narrowly, these people publish catalogs of names, you know, as though we're not trying to accomplish any useful social purpose, that we never get to debate. Should that be allowed? Should a man in Hooker's position with his reputation be allowed to do that and then using his credentials, phony credentials then, as a scholar, relate on a first-name, intimate basis to the leaders of liberation movements in exile in London, which he did for many years, with the heads of state of newly independent countries in the Caribbean, which he did for years, and so on and so forth. That's the kind of thing that's involved in this. Now, certainly, an exposure of that kind poses risks, but what about the risks to all those people? Nobody seems to be too concerned about what Hooker's work may have done to bring an awful lot of very courageous people to early graves, but we're concerned about that.
What was the CIA response after you published your report about James Hooker?
I'm not aware of one. And incidentally, but there again, all of my methods were standard investigative journalism. I had no access to classified information. I had no access, no leaks from people who did have access to classified information. It was a straight reporting job. And yet, that disclosure will be outlawed whenever the Congress finally agrees on the wording of this law and both houses enact the same wording. It's in conference committee as we're talking, so within the next couple of weeks it may be law.
Because of that, the Covert Action Information Bulletin has suspended the naming names column. Is that
right.
Correct? Why?
We're not interested in being martyrs. We certainly think that this is an attack not only on our freedom, but the freedom of an awful lot of other people under the First Amendment. You may have noticed in the news that in the past few weeks, this U.S. attorney in California was forced to resign from office for having confirmed a story in the San Diego Union that a leading Mexican official was a source for the CIA. Now, that story and that publication and that federal official who made the disclosure would all be subject to penalties. In fact, the U.S. attorney, the way the law is written, would be subject to more severe penalties than the newspaper that published the information because he had access to classified information, whereas they were only using regular journalistic techniques. All of that and all the wire service stories about it and so forth would be outlawed, will be outlawed, because it looks certainly like this bill is about to be law. So what we want to do is mount a legal challenge to it. We're not interested in wasting away in a penitentiary. We want to, we plan to go into court the minute that the bill is law and challenge it, and we hope win.
It's clear that the Bulletin is not very happy with the media coverage of it and the narrow focus on the naming names column. However, if this does go into law, and do you see yourself allied with some of the major media who will also feel that this would be a repressive act towards them?
We do. The question is whether they do. Now, some of them certainly do. Some of them have been very consistent in editorially expressing the opinion that this bill is an attack not only on us but on them, and that we will all hang together. Others, and I think naively, believe that somehow it's possible to deny our freedom of the press while not denying theirs. And I think that that's a very dangerous thing. I think, in fact, that's the CIA's strategy, to divide some of them from us, to weaken the resolve of the press as a whole, and to chip away that way. But in fact, when it comes right down to it, the CIA has said this story on the West Coast has damaged them severely by revealing one of their highest-level sources. And yet the story was that this U.S. attorney wants to prosecute this Mexican official because he's involved in an international auto theft ring, and that the CIA blocked the prosecution. That's precisely why we think that this kind of thing can't be allowed to go into law. The very idea that a story like that shouldn't be reported, which is the Congress's attitude, is abhorrent to us.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Kenneth Lawrence, who is a journalist, and among other reports and studies that he's authored, he is on the editorial board of the Covert Action Information Bulletin, which we're discussing right now. There seem to be two emerging groups who are of political significance, who are very unhappy with the government right now, a very wide group that is rallying behind problems with the economy, and perhaps a smaller, maybe more of a white middle-class group who are concerned with arms freeze and nuclear power, energy use, and so forth. Do you see yourself allied with these groups, and how do you think they relate to you?
Well, that's a good question. In Mississippi, some of these things that are more familiarly white middle class in other areas of the country are, in fact, quite heavily black and poor. For example, I've been an activist in the anti-nuclear power movement as well as the anti-nuclear bomb movement for many, many years. And in Mississippi, where the Mississippi Power and Light Company is building is intended to be the largest nuclear reactor in the world in a 70% black county, the movement against nuclear power is overwhelmingly black and led, in fact, by the elected officials of that county, endorsed by the NAACP there in Port Gibson, which is, in fact, I think, contrary to national NAACP policy. I think nationally the NAACP, if anything, leans in the pro-nuclear direction, but in Port Gibson, they have unanimously taken a position against this reactor. I'm certainly involved in that movement, the disarmament movement. I think that there's no question that all of us who are concerned about the repression generally and that conducted by the intelligence agencies in particular are heavily involved in all of those activities. I have been since the 50s, and you know, if anything, that was some of my earliest activities, and it was in the course of that I increasingly got into these various areas of specialty as far as my journalism is concerned.
Well, would it be fair to assume that the large portion of the working class who is now starting to rally behind economic issues and the nuclear concerned groups, is it fair to assume that they'd still be fairly hostile to what they perceive to be your work, or do you see a coming together?
Well, there's certainly a coming together. I told you, I've been in Mississippi now for more than 10 years, and as a white person, I felt that my major responsibility has been to reach other white people, particularly around racial issues and so forth, and to do my part to change those attitudes of racism and oppression. And I certainly am willing to concede that this is not an easy task and not one that I can recite a whole long list of successes. But recently there have been some that I think are quite significant. I was invited to speak last month twice at one of the very conservative white Baptist churches on the question of disarmament, an audience that I'd never been asked to address before. My reception was quite cordial, and this constituency is, after all, the one that put Reagan in the White House and now is getting quite nervous about what he's doing. And as one of them said, when another attacked me with the fairly traditional conservative line, but one of his own fellow parishioners said to him, listen, we know what your position is. We've heard it for 40 years, and now we need to hear some new ideas. Some of these people are industrial workers. It's a new area for them. I certainly feel a wariness. You know, they're not comfortable in the same room with me, many of them. And I think, therefore, it's even more to their credit that they are taking that kind of a step. This is true of labor people and so on. I mean, you know, it's new. It hasn't happened before. And I think it's an exciting development.
Have you thought very much about the prospects of presenting your work in what might be thought of a more mainstream context, such as, the major independent papers or magazines? I don't know, anything from Playboy to the Village Voice to, the New York Times and so forth.
Well, we certainly are used quite often as sources by those publications and, well, by writers for those publications, often without acknowledgement. And to a certain extent, we regret that we don't get the credit for our work. On the other hand, there's no question in my mind that the result, getting the information out, is more important than getting the credit for it. So, you know, we suffer a little from that. And as I mentioned earlier, it's common for us to be asked for detailed information and research by the very same people who condemn us publicly. And we don't like it. But it is the situation we're in. And we still think that, on balance, it's important to cooperate and offer as much help as we can to reporters who are trying to report these things.
What's the difference between between you and a Jack Anderson in terms of how the public perceives somebody like Jack Anderson, how the major editorial industry would perceive him, whereas your work is frequently condemned, his is published and syndicated. What's the difference?
Well, I think the difference is that we are persistent critics of this kind of activity. We don't believe that the CIA is reformable. We think that what they call intelligence gathering has no place, no legitimate place. And what might be considered legitimate intelligence is not something that they engage in. And so people who are generally sympathetic to their existence but occasionally expose something that they consider to be unreasonable activity, people like that have the continuing respectability that we don't. I mean, we are critics. We don't believe that the FBI or the CIA are reformable, and That's not a position that the mainstream press right now is prepared to accept.
Do you feel that you yourself would be able to contribute an article to the New York Times under your name with your associations, or not just the New York Times, but any major independent daily newspaper?
It hasn't been entirely excluded as a possibility. It's likelier to be in an opinion piece than in a reporting piece. And, you know, I mean, we do have access to journals like The Nation, which is, you know, liberal, obviously, and identifiably so, but nevertheless has a wider readership than Covert Action Information Bulletin has, and other similar publications. I think some of the ones you named would probably accept certain kinds of things from us if we offered it to them. But on the whole, there's no question they'd be wary. Now, despite that, we get fairer coverage now than we did a few years ago, I think. Partly this is because belatedly some of the media are seeing that they are in the same boat with us, that the attack on us is in fact also a veiled attack on them. But also there is a growing concern, I think, and I think we can legitimately claim credit for having helped arouse that concern. So I don't feel antagonistic. I wish they didn't. You know, I wish they didn't feel the need routinely to condemn us whenever they also use us as a source.
What magazines and papers do you read?
Well, I subscribe to about 100 publications myself. I read the daily newspapers in Jackson, which are not the greatest in the country. I have to admit I don't read the New York Times and the Washington Post because everybody else I know does and sends me clippings of everything they think I'd be interested in. So I subscribe to the Manchester Guardian. I read most of the left and liberal weeklies. I subscribe to publications from and about Africa, the Middle East. I monitor all of the mercenary publications. That's a special area of my research. Other occasional specialties. But basically, I try and keep up. And I should add, all points of view. I mean, I read regularly all the material that the South African government sends out, as well as all the stuff from the liberation movements and that the United States government puts out and so forth. I subscribe to publications from both East and West Germany, you know, from Cuba and from Cuban exile groups and so forth.
What are you looking for when in your survey of the mercenary magazines? And if you could mention some of those magazines.
Soldier of Fortune, Gung Ho, Eagle, one that doesn't exist anymore called Vigilante, some that come and go. There's a new one that's just started up whose name I don't recall now. And then there's this whole galaxy of so-called survivalist publications that are a concentric circle around the mercenary ones. Well, the reason why I monitor them is twofold. One is because they overlap very heavily with the Klan and the Nazis, and to a certain extent it's a matter of self-preservation. My life has been threatened often enough by these folks that I need to keep track of who they are and what they're doing. And one of the people who was personally terrorizing me was among that group of Klansmen who were going to try and overthrow the government of Dominica and are currently serving time in federal prison for it. However, that's also the same constituency from which the intelligence agencies recruit when they are in the business of trying to overthrow a government they don't like. I mean, there aren't a whole lot of people like that who like to run off and wage small wars and kill people, you know. So It serves two purposes: to watch what they're doing, and to see who they are, and you learn by reading them what targets they're working on. For example, Gung Ho magazine last May ran an article which was virtually recruiting mercenaries for the recent coup attempt in the Seychelles that was run from South Africa. And by keeping close tabs on what these people are projecting as where there's work for mercenaries, we can get a pretty good idea of what they're up to and who's behind it, and do our part to try and stop them.
How do you test yourself in terms of, you know, you've mentioned that you've had death threats. That's not been unusual, just about everybody I know thinks at one time or another that their phone is tapped, but you don't really know unless, well, you can pursue it through FOIA or something, but usually you don't really know. So it's always sort of a balancing act of trying to keep in touch with what you think might be occurring around you or to you, but on the other hand, having to sort of do a little bit of reality testing and perhaps, you know, be wary of when you might be overreacting. Do you have a way of filtering through that yourself?
Well, it's certainly a reasonable assumption that all of our phones are tapped and our mail is read, whether anybody else's is or not. I mean, they've certainly not been shy about naming us as one of their targets, that is, the people associated with the bulletin, including Philip Agee and the rest of us. So I think there's no question there. On the other hand, as people who are not engaged in conspiracies and illegality, it's certainly a violation of our rights, but I think that there's no question that the main reason that they do this sort of thing is in the hopes of finding out in advance what we're trying to do and maybe disrupt it a little. So we work around that as best we can. But I don't think... My old friend Carl Braden taught me when I first moved to Mississippi that if you spend all your time looking over your shoulder, sooner or later you trip and break your neck. And I think you've got to be pretty sober about that sort of thing and just keep your eyes focused on the job that needs to be done and be reasonably cautious. But
What type of precautions in your lifestyle did you find yourself taking?
I have various plans to defend myself if necessary. I have a permit to carry a weapon and that sort of thing. I think the people who would like to put a stop to what I'm doing are aware that I don't do foolish things.
This is a little bit off the subject, but I'm wondering if you saw Missing.
Sure.
What was your reception to the film?
Oh, I thought it was a wonderful film, and I think I have to say, with all the work that all of us have been doing all these years, that film has probably done more to reach people who need to know what kinds of dirty activities the United States has engaged in, and particularly its role in the overthrow and murder of Allende in Chile, than any of the things that the rest of us have been able to do put together. So I greatly appreciate it.
Well, thanks very much for being here this afternoon.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.